It's good. Rebecca graduated in education from BYU, where she received her BA and her master's. She teaches English. They've both been teachers throughout most of their adult life. She now works at an independent school for girls called the Laurel School. And she's also guest edited The Exponent and has contributed much writing to Dialogue and Exponent. And Neil Chandler will be providing comments after that. He did his undergraduate work at the U of U and went on to Princeton after that. He taught German literature and philosophy and then changed to creative writing. He's now the director of creative writing at Cleveland State University. And he's also the author of a popular book called Benediction, A Collection of Stories, which is probably available in the lobby here today. They're both lifetime members of the church who grew up in Salt Lake City, and especially with the nature of this paper and these comments, you'll probably be hearing a lot more about them from them, so I'll let you get to that. Thank you.
Last spring, the Washington, D.C. Sunstone approached me to be a part of a panel on different kinds of families. They had a single person who represented the individual as a family unit, and they had an individual who was married to a non-member, and they wanted me to represent families like ours that are blended. And it was the very, very first time anyone had ever asked me to address this subject publicly, and it was the occasion for a lot of reflection and recollection and dredging up some things that in many ways were painful, but I found I had more to say than I could possibly say in 10 minutes on a panel, and I'm just curious, are you here because you're in the same situation, many of you? We're hoping that we'll be able to have a discussion and include you. Part of the problem we felt all along is that we haven't had anyone to talk to. We haven't had anyone to share our situation with, and so we'd very much like to make this an inclusive session, but I will begin with what I wound up writing that on that occasion. I called it Family Ties just for a file in the computer, and it was Neil who suggested Family Sutures was more important or was more appropriate. So I'll read that, and then we'll try and involve all of you. Last summer, I discovered an old friend in a literary footnote. We had been neighborhood playmates and then high school colleagues, walking to school together every day, sharing classes, sharing an orchestra stand, sharing our first our childhood and then our adolescence generally. But with graduation, she had left for Radcliffe, I for BYU, and our families had both moved away from the neighborhood. We stayed in touch for a year or two, but with the instability of college addresses, regrettably lost touch with each other, until this sudden confrontation with her name after so many years. Eager for some news of her life since I saw her last, I wrote to her through her publisher. While I waited for a reply, I couldn't help wondering if trying to reestablish this old friendship really wasn't a pretty dumb idea, after all. What besides old memories were we likely to have in common now? She was obviously a scholar, associated with a university, possibly still unmarried. I teach eighth grade, and I'm bringing up the last of six or eight children. She had a Jewish background and had declared her personal atheism in junior high school. I remained, by comparison, the rather quaint, generally active Mormon she had known in high school. But when she did reply almost by return mail, it was clear to me that we would establish common ground in very short order. A little overwhelmed by the size of the family I described to her, she wrote that she had, in fact, never had children, but that she had tried to be a good aunt to her nieces and nephews, and that she had recently married a man with three sons, to whom she was trying to be a not-too-wicked stepmother, she hoped. That innocuous little phrase, not-too-wicked stepmother, leaped off the page. I knew what she meant, and I knew how she felt, because I am a stepmother also. When I responded to her letter, I remarked, being a stepmother is the hardest thing I have ever tried to do. And the literary critic in my friend seized on the last three words, tried to do. Three or four pages of frustrations, recriminations, and justifications followed. Frustrations, recriminations, and justifications I have experienced many times in the 18 years I have held the title of stepmother, of not too wicked stepmother, I hope. It has been my experience that such feelings of frustration and inadequacy are pretty universal to the task. Despite the rosy portrayals from television's Brady Bunch and idealistic 50s movies like Always Room for One More, few people feel that they actually succeed at being a step-parent, and fewer ever talk about the task that they are trying to accomplish. Step-parenting is somehow just not a subject that comes up in polite conversation very often. It is a solitary enterprise that leaves one feeling estranged from all the wrong people, most notably from one's spouse, but also virtually all other family members in both generational directions who would be likely to take sides, and most friends and colleagues as well who simply wouldn't have any basis for understanding the problems. In the almost 2 decades of my second marriage, I've encountered few people to actually share this experience with, and this is the very first time I've ever been asked to address the subject publicly. When Neil and I were married on the grounds of the Kirtland Temple in 1975, we blended a family of 4 sons, 2 little boys from each of our previous marriages. They happened to be pretty much all the same age and constituted a clump of noise and activity between 4 and 8 years old. Because we had both been divorced, which was why we were on the grounds of a temple instead of inside one, these boys would spend the next several years commuting between the home we established in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, and those of their other parents, who both happened to live in Utah. Generally, Neil's boys, Colin and Hanno, lived in Salt Lake with their mother during the school year and spent summers with us, and my boys, Brian and Brad Cagle, lived with us and spent summers with their dad in Provo. In 1976, Neil and I had a daughter, and delighted to have a girl in the family, named her Michael. The plan was to have possibly one other permanent resident child that we didn't have to share with anyone else, preferably another girl, and preferably 2 or 3 years from that time so we could enjoy these babies one at a time. 22 months later, Michael's little sister, Leslie, appeared unbidden with a twin brother in tow. We named him Quinn because he was the 5th of our sons collectively and the 5th child of each of his parents individually, and then took a deep breath, assuming that our family was complete. 3.5 years later, under circumstances that rival the Immaculate Conception, another daughter appeared. We named her Alexis for no reason in particular. Because we are both language teachers and tend to think in grammatical terms, we refer to this brood as our compound complex family. That is, you may remember, a structure in which 2 or more independent clauses are joined by 1 or more dependent clauses. But semantics is not the issue here. Whether we call families like ours blended, reconstituted, or anything else catchy and somewhat personalized, in an attempt to avoid the clearly pejorative step family, a forbidding array of problems remain. All such families, all of them, are born of loss. Either the loss of a spouse and therefore a parent through death, or the loss of a marriage and all the hopes and plans and dreams that that implies through divorce, and a parent as well for the children. All are an attempt to salvage what one can, not a brave creation of a new family, an eternal family in Mormon parlance, on its own terms. Families like ours are unique in the particular circumstances that precipitated their creation in the first place, and then the conditions that surround their daily acting out, but they do have a number of problems in common. Possibly the most elemental is, in fact, the problem of self-definition. What exactly is your relationship to these children? If their mother has died, and if you have adopted them, and if they are comfortable with you as their new mother, then you have only an adjustment period, possibly a prolonged and maybe even a painful one to deal with, but an adjustment can eventually be made. But if they have a mother, and if they only spend part of their time with you, what is your role exactly? How much input can you reasonably expect to have, and can you reasonably be expected to have, in decisions that affect them, in determining expectations, and in setting limits? What, in fact, should they call you? How should they be expected to treat you? What precisely do they owe you? Loyalty and outright love are usually reserved for the natural parent. What is left for you, who may be assuming all kinds of parental responsibilities, such as cooking their meals, washing their clothes, supervising their activities, transporting them here and there, and more often than not, working as well to help pay the child support, payments, and travel expenses? What do they owe you for all this? Obedience? Respect? Affection? Civility? Any and all interactions between stepchildren and parents are likely to be fraught with emotional overtones and undercurrents of tension. parents, grandparents, child psychologists, and anyone else who feels compelled to comment on the situation will generally express great concern that children of divorce feel loved and that they not be made to feel in any way responsible for their parents' marital dissatisfaction. While this kind of reassurance is clearly central to a child's sense of himself and his well-being, parents can sometimes find themselves tripping all over themselves and all over each other, trying to keep children happy and secure in ways that may in fact be detrimental to them. Children may be as vulnerable as they sometimes seem to be, but they can also become manipulative in very short order and learn to play the situation to their own advantage. Parents sometimes have a hard time acknowledging a situation for what it is and an even harder time figuring out what to do about it. Disciplining children under the circumstances in which most stepchildren are raised is difficult, not only for the so-called step-parent, but for the natural, albeit part-time parent as well. If the child divides his time between two households, and if standards of conduct are dramatically different, or even if they are only somewhat different, how reasonable is it to hold the child to such a fluid line? What if you have limited time with your child and would like that time to be as pleasant as possible? You can't spend the entire visit dressing him down and expect that he will ever even want to come back again, now can you? This is one area in which children can easily learn to avoid responsibility or perhaps evade consequences for misconduct, and they often do become quite skilled at playing their parents off against each other. If the parents can get together on some policy decisions and hold a mutual line, the child certainly stands to benefit in the long run. But many marriages broke up in the first place because parents couldn't agree and couldn't work together. Divorce doesn't change that dynamic, and adding other parents isn't likely to help either. Neither is adding other children, because such problems are often exacerbated if there are step-siblings or later half-siblings in the household who are being held to other expectations. It is important to note that these kinds of conflicts are often a day-in and day-out, all-day-long kind of issue that just doesn't go away, whether the subject is household responsibilities, attention to schoolwork, music lessons, bedtime, television time, curfews, spending money, church attendance, Sabbath observance, using standard English grammar or the Lord's name, covering one's mouth or cleaning one's plate. The problems of ongoing child rearing are arguably far more difficult for many stepmothers than they are for most stepfathers. Women are, as a rule, more intensively involved in the day-to-day operation of almost any given household, whether they also work outside the home or not, than are most men, and most men will concede that this is true. There also seems to be an emotional level that may be biological because of the process of childbirth, or may be more closely tied to infant bonding when their children were very young, that is harder for them to transcend when they are dealing with another woman's children. It is also true that step-parenting is likely to affect their daily lives far more than it will their husbands. Many note, ruefully, that when their husband's children come for a visit, he is likely to be busy with work or other responsibilities, and the kids actually wind up spending the bulk of that visit with their stepmother. It doesn't help either fathers or mothers that their stepchildren are a visible reminder of a past that their spouse shared with someone else, and it certainly doesn't help if that someone else resents them and makes sure that the children are well aware of that resentment. In such a situation, nothing a step-parent does seems to work. Efforts go unacknowledged, the best of intentions are impinged, motivations are suspect. It's hard sometimes not to give up altogether. And indeed, many people do. Divorce statistics for second marriages that include children are not encouraging, and stresses with step-parenting are cited far more frequently as the cause for such separations than any other single factor. Many children of divorce do cherish a fond hope that their parents will get back together again, however unrealistic that hope may be, and many will campaign subtly or overtly towards such an end. While they will statistically almost never succeed at getting their parents remarried, they may, in fact, manage to contribute significantly to the demise of a current marriage. There are other areas of common concern among blended families. Family finances is one that always seems to raise some level of resentment. It is rare to encounter a divorced couple who feel that their child support arrangements are completely fair. More commonly, just about everyone involved feels ill-used, with one parent, usually the father or the father's new wife, feeling that he's contributing more than he can reasonably afford and perhaps commenting unfavorably about how the money is being spent, and the other parent, usually the mother, feeling that she isn't getting nearly what she needs or nearly what the father can afford to contribute. It is, frankly, expensive to raise children in today's world, and it is very expensive if those children are being raised in more than one household. Unless someone has a very good job with an excellent salary, or there is an inheritance somewhere, or a winning lottery ticket, and that also assumes that the individual who has access to these resources is willing to share them with all the people who need this. The children's standard of living will probably be lower after the divorce than it was before. Typically, mothers who may have been able to stay home with their children will need to go to work at this point to supplement whatever is promised in child support, and less commonly today, alimony. Working mothers incur their own expenses, such as additional taxes, transportation costs, perhaps a bigger, better wardrobe, and quite often child care as well, which alone can run into several hundred dollars a month. It is frustrating for all concerned when paychecks, however well managed, just don't seem to stretch as far as the demands of such a family situation require. Financial pressures such as these can add to the difficulties between parents and stepchildren, because it is difficult for stepparents not to resent the money that is being spent on these children, who may seem unaware of the sacrifices they require, especially when it so seldom seems to occur to them to say thank you. Logistics can cause problems as well. In our case, the children commuted close to 2,000 miles twice a year or so as we could arrange travel and visitation. We didn't pretend that such an arrangement was a good one. There was far too much time between visits, little opportunity to be part of the ongoing daily life of Neil's children, and far too much that happened that neither one of us could be a part of. Families who live closer to each other and who visit more frequently have a number of advantages over what I have described, but from what I see in the daily lives of some of my students, a very difficult set of problems to deal with as well. The recent trend toward joint custody, in which children spend a part of each week with each parent, often on virtually a 50-50 basis, for example, seems to address the parents' needs to spend time with their children at the expense of security and stability for the children themselves. As one of my eighth graders put it, the book you are reading is always on the night table at the other house. The blouse that goes with the skirt you want to wear is in the other closet. The parent who knows how to do the homework that is due tomorrow is always the other one. When families are sharing children, there is a potential for problems with just about any family ritual, with holidays, with birthdays, with school activities. Indeed, just about any event in the life of a child can be occasion for yet another episode in the life of a stepchild. Moreover, custody arrangements, however thoughtfully, carefully, or perhaps acrimoniously arrived at, seldom remain consistently in force until a child has grown up without some modification, and those modifications may or may not be agreed upon amicably. In addition to these day-to-day problems, parents share an overriding concern, an ongoing anxiety, really, that their children will suffer irreparable damage from their status as children from a broken home. Fears that any number of people, sometimes unwittingly and sometimes quite overtly, will play upon. It is hard not to feel at a disadvantage, for example, in a parent-teacher conference, if you yourself darkly fear that your marital status has somehow contributed to your child's difficulties with, say, algebra. And as children grow up and sometimes encounter significant problems of one kind or another, parents often vacillate between evaluating the situation realistically on its own merits and repeatedly blaming themselves for having been unable to raise their children in an intact family. The actual effects of divorce on children have been under reevaluation since the mid-70s, when the divorce rate peaked in the United States. Now, 20 years later, a generation of children has been raised in statistically significant numbers in single-parent or blended families, prompting yet another reexamination of what hard data is available. We'll discuss this aspect of the problem more extensively in the second part of this session. I only wish to mention here that in the atmosphere of doubt and fear that often surrounds divorce and or remarriage, neither parents nor children can easily thrive. Emotional conflicts are many, and support is often hard to find. And I know that I've been generalizing up to this point, and I know that good writers don't generalize. Good writers support every assertion with specific, concrete examples. And I could do that, but for the privacy of our family, for the healing that we feel has taken place over the years, I can't see the point of dredging up specific examples. But I can say to you that we have experienced everything I've mentioned so far. There are a couple of things we haven't that I have read about, problems that come up in other blended families that we did not have to deal with. And one of these is a problem with abuse. There are statistically huge numbers of kids who get involved in abuse situations because of step-parents or step-siblings in the home, something like 40 times more frequently than intact families. We didn't have any daughters, and there are sometimes problems with daughters and stepfathers. Sometimes the girls find sort of flirtatious ways to manipulate their stepfathers, and the stepmother or the mother resents this very much. Sometimes the father create problems for her. Another problem we didn't deal with was inheritance. In some cases, you have one child in the family who has the expectations of inheriting a great deal of money from grandparents, and this money will not be shared with other children in the family. And so you have one child growing up with the expectations that he or she can go to college anywhere she wishes and that she'll have all this money later on, and other children who will not share in that because the family inheritance is not the same. So there are all kinds of other problems that I haven't dealt with, but I hope this gives you an idea of what families are up against under even the best of circumstances, I think. Which leads to the question of how well the Mormon community does at providing strength and support to families that are dealing with these kinds and numbers of problems. Unhappily, the news here is not all that it might be. A church that uses as its veritable password, "No success anywhere can compensate for failure in the home," is not always a safe haven for a blended family. For both theological and social reasons, families like ours generally assume second-class status, at best, in a typical Mormon ward. The parents may not have a celestial marriage, at least not to each other. They may, in fact, be sealed to other people. The children certainly aren't sealed to these parents or to most of their siblings. Every time an eternal family is glorified from the pulpit, in a lesson, in a hymn, so-called blended families may feel excluded. While other families can be together forever with Heavenly Father's plan, the fate of families like ours hangs in limbo. Many faithful Latter-day Saints are reassured that such matters will be taken care of in time and that all concerned will in fact be happy with the outcome. But constant reminders that your household, that is your paperwork, is not in order, that in fact your situation may be unorderable, can be very difficult to deal with. Members who have been widowed are encouraged to think of themselves as still married to, but temporarily separated from, their eternal companions. It must be difficult for an individual with such a mindset to make the kind of commitment to a second, merely mortal marriage that marriage requires. It must be particularly difficult if the second spouse is on an uneven footing in that respect. Different eternal expectations. Divorced couples have to deal with a cancellation of sealing if they wish to have their current marriage sealed in the temple. This is a cumbersome and often painful process that involves numerous interviews and letters with little respect for the privacy of those concerned, and is required only of the wife. As long as he is worthy of a temple recommend, a man is not required to submit to this process and is permitted to be sealed to a second or a third or a fourth wife, whether his first marriage ended because of death or divorce. While there are members of the church who are not uncomfortable with this vestige of polygamy, there are those who are. And discussion of the issues involved can be very stressful for the parents and sometimes for the children as well. Little children cannot reasonably be expected to have the maturity to deal with such confusion, and they may wind up feeling that their families are not all that they should be, that their parents, because they wound up in such a situation, are not particularly good role models for them, or that they are themselves somehow inferior because they were born into family situations that are not strictly kosher. Sometimes as they grow older, children simply come to resent the institution that seems to have caused such ambivalence and emotional turmoil in the first place. Within a given Mormon community, when a spouse has died, there is sympathy for the surviving spouse and general support for a remarriage. But many committed Mormons are uncomfortable with divorce in any form and take no particular pains to hide that fact. Allowances may be made for those perceived to be clearly victimized, and you know the kind I mean. Over the quilt in a Relief Society, someone will say, "You know, his wife left him," or, "You know, her husband turned out to be a homosexual." And as long as the problems are in those categories, there's support for the divorce. But beyond that, many see marriage covenants, especially temple covenants, as inviolate, and have little respect for anyone who would choose to end a marriage for almost any reason. I can't say that this attitude has been articulated in hierarchical circles, but it is unusual to find anyone with a history of divorce in a position of leadership on the ward or the stake level, and I don't know of any among the rank authorities. It is also difficult simply to find the time and often the money to be an active member of the church when family commitments are as overwhelming as some I have tried to describe, and when it is essential that both partners work to support the reconstituted family. By the time child support payments are made and often child care expenses are figured in as well, 10% of a gross annual salary may represent a much larger percentage of what is finally left over for a couple to actually live on than it does for most families, and certainly for individuals living alone. This is a problem that is seldom acknowledged, but it is very real, and it can leave parents feeling depleted and defensive. Equally depleting are the demands on their time. When, after all these family and work commitments, do you find time for community and church service? For yourself, for each other. How can you nourish this marriage that brought you all together in the first place? Our own experience in our own stake has been that overwhelmingly, families like ours simply do not remain active in the church. Statistically, the LDS population has a divorce and a remarriage rate that rather closely parallels the national average. Where are all these people? In the years we have lived in Kirtland Stakes since our remarriage, I can think of only a handful of active LDS families we have known who've been in our situation. Interestingly and regrettably, about half the families we were able to think of have since divorced, and the other half, while still together, are no longer active Latter-day Saints. In our ward right now, there is one other active couple who are in a second marriage, and only one that I know of in the ward that shares our building. It's always harder to go it alone, and I certainly feel that we could have used some mutual support along the way that for various reasons seems to have never been available to us within the church. I've tried to be honest here about the difficulties and frustrations we have encountered, but I think it's also important to acknowledge what has gone well and to conclude on as upbeat as I possibly can. If success can be defined by the quality of our effort rather than by comparison with the desired results, then I think that Neil and I deserve to feel a measure of success because we have both tried within the means that have been available to us to be fair to all our children and to be fair to our former spouses, to live the gospel and to contribute to our ward. Our four oldest sons are now grown. Three have married and have some distance, some perspective on their own childhood and on their parents. They value their relationship with us and with each other and with their younger siblings. All seem to remember any number of good times far more clearly than they harbor resentments. We are grateful for their maturity, for their understanding, and to some extent for some actual healing that has taken place. All of these young men have made decisions along the way that have from time to time disappointed us or given us cause for real concern. Raising boys is not easy under the best of circumstances, and it is sometimes difficult for us to sort out what kinds of problems we can attribute to the fact that they were raised as they were, and which we might have had to deal with in any case. We have been disappointed that overwhelmingly these boys have not chosen to pursue church activity as adults. Only one has served a mission and married in the temple. Two have married outside the church altogether. We're not sure what to expect from the fourth. Last summer, for the first time in many years, I managed to get the entire tribe together as a surprise for Neil's 50th birthday, and it was, in fact, a joyful experience. Despite some lifestyles that are not strictly parallel with each other or with ours, we seem to function pretty well as a family. We like each other, and we enjoy each other's company. On a good day, Neil and I can actually think of some things we must have done right, and are grateful that our marriage has been a strong and happy one from virtually any standpoint, despite the difficulties I have described. We're not sorry we did all this, but it is honestly overwhelming to even contemplate ever undertaking to do it again.
Well, I have read and discussed my wife's presentation two or three times, and I wanted to respond to it in a much less formal and less organized way than I usually approach things, because my feelings about this are very much in flux. In fact, have changed again in the last two or three days as we've spent time with our children. Some ideas, some impressions that I have been fixed over time and are embedded in sort of ideas that I have about marriage, one of which we have often also discussed, and that is that the purpose and burden of marriage is really fundamentally to have somebody to blame, which I think is true, and I think our children soon learn and understand. I can give you an example of that. My wife is very proud of her driving record. Having had no moving violations ever in her life, something she announces to me regularly when I seem to be appraising her driving skills. Although several years ago, three or four or five, she actually got a ticket for speeding in Pennsylvania, far from home, and didn't tell me. The children told me. And one of the older children sitting at this session was grinning with a Cheshire grin, and I said, "What are you up to? What are you thinking about?" And he sat there and he said, "Neil, I'm just wondering how this is going to be your fault." And it turned out to be my fault. One thing I've told my children is that when you marry, they don't listen to me, but I've told them. And you decide you want to marry somebody, you have to be willing to accept the fact that you are marrying her family, her childhood, whatever strengths are there, but also whatever disappointments and scars and imperfections and fears. And to try to console her or to make up for her, to her for those things, and probably inadequately so. Those disappointments are there. And she has to be willing to do the same thing with and for you. And that's difficult. And it means a lot of pounding and a lot of getting used to one another and learning to accept those things. You need to have somebody who's imperfect enough to be blamable and perfect enough to accept the blame with some degree of grace. And that goes on. In families like our own, you not only accept your spouse's childhood and whatever difficulties and burdens arise from that, but also whatever loss came from the former marriage. Maybe a loss of a spouse or death. But more commonly, it's the loss of the relationship, the failure of the relationship, and the burdens of that failed relationship, and whatever insecurities and fears arose from that, and whatever patterns of behavior, self-defensive behavior often, have been constructed around the self in order to maintain stability and to be safe. Those are defenses, and you have to live with those too. And if you add on top of those two levels of structure of things to deal with, children who have their own hurts and their own demands, it becomes very, very complex and very demanding. And luckily, I think early on, you have no idea what the dimensions of those things are. I think there are major areas of influence. Important influence that in some ways are missing. The first and for me most important one as I look back is the question of bonding. Just two nights ago I was watching my second oldest son stretched out on the floor with his brand new infant daughter, and she was sitting on his chest and she had a hold of his hair, a handful of hair on each side of his head, and was happily, elaborately drooling into his eyes, and he loved it. And as I watched him, I could remember when he was her size and he sat on my chest and drooled into my face, and I loved it. I can remember all those experiences with my small children. And they made it much easier for me on the day when, as an adolescent, he was sent home from school for having given himself a mohawk. Self-inflicted a mohawk and being expelled and being completely unrepentant and miserable and impossible to deal with. On that day, it was immensely easier for me to deal with him, and not for my wife, I should say that. I was out of town. because I remembered, well, yes, but I was under charge to deal with this child. Times that were different. On the other hand, when another child, and I was home, a 12-year-old boy, took out a car while we were absent and drove it around the block at speeds beyond belief and careened into the garage. We're talking about a 12-year-old boy. I drop-kicked him through the garage roof. And I have to wonder now, if that had been a child who drooled into my face when he was much younger, if I'd have reacted in the same way. It's a difficult thing. Children are hard to raise. That's a very good line. Boys are tremendously, at least in our experience, difficult to raise. And I think bonding makes it bearable. Makes it much easier. And when you encounter your stepchildren, you have not shared those experiences. They're in this way strangers. And much as those discussions you have with your spouse about other people's children, the way they're raised and the way they're behaving, and in our home, suddenly those children arrive in your home. And that makes it difficult. Any such arrangement, any such marriage, is in effect, and as Beck pointed out, born of loss. Maybe the loss of a parent, one parent, a death, and that is difficult, and that is hard to bear, and blame for that needs placing. It may be the loss of a marriage about which children are normally resentful, and in a way rightly so. And so part of the problem becomes for everybody defining the enemy. And historically, that burden has fallen largely, that is in popular perception, on stepmothers. Stepmother is a very well-known, famous historical concept. It always occurs with the adjective wicked. It's in all the fairy tales. It's in all the old tales. There are great classical stories involving wicked stepmothers. She's been predefined before she ever arrives. She's even ahead of mothers-in-law. I mean, difficult. And if we can look at just one example that has occurred to me because I was looking at it for other reasons recently. The story of Cinderella, and you can even think of the Disney movie, The Wicked, Wicked Stepmother, who encounters Cinderella, beautiful, charming, gifted girl. And if you remember the movie, and if you remember the story, and here are her own children, ugly, clumpy, ill-mannered, and her reaction, in a rather unkind way, is to defend her ugly children against the child with all the natural gifts. And it's vicious behavior. But in a sense, it's very natural behavior. These are girls who need all the defense they can get. And of course, they don't end up with the prize. These are children who are probably only lovely if you held them on your chest when they were young and they drooled into your eyes and you loved them. Wicked stepmothers are quite obvious. I think discovering how wicked stepfathers can be is a relatively new phenomenon. I am constantly shocked by the stories I hear of abuse, by the revelations, which probably should not be revelations of what sort of things take place between stepfathers and children, fathers and children, and certainly between stepfathers or boyfriends and children. That there is a long history and a terrible one of abuse. And it seems to me, or I hope, that certainly in most cases, a certain kind of bonding, a closeness to your children's innocence and a sense of that, and they're very small, mitigates that. When you encounter stepchildren, you often don't encounter them as innocent at all. They seem guilty by their behavior and by their attitudes, and it's much, much harder to preserve a sense of their viability and of their innocence. I think there's a third person at work here that we only alluded to, or Beck did, but certainly alive, and that is the wicked, wicked stepchild. Stepchildren are defining the enemy. They know that something terrible has happened to them, and they know that an enemy hath done this. And part of their life's work here is to define who that is. And it's very easy, I think, to define it as the other parent. I can't tell you how often I have heard, "You are not my father." And those are painful reasons for words for two reasons. One is because it sets up a relationship of defiance, of difficulty, where the natural bonds, the natural rights of parenthood are not resources upon which you can easily call. And secondly, because it's true in a very fundamental kind of way and continues to be true. And children defend themselves not so much from you and what you're trying to accomplish. I mean, it might just be getting the garage or room cleaned up or getting them to church on time, but from whatever it is that has happened to them in their lives that they resent so deeply or they've been hurt by deeply. And so they take on the ambitions and the roles of commandos, subversive roles. And the difficulty is not to treat them like occupying forces have always treated commandos and subversives, with repression. It's a natural act. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm trying to think and talk, and so it's hard to put volume into it. I think there is another time, or maybe I should go ahead of myself a little. I think there is a way of discovering stepchildren over time that is different than the way we discover children. And that is, over time, discovering one another's mutual vulnerability. That is, you learn, because you're thrown in intense situations with each other, that you have to deal with one another. You are not fooled into believing that one another perfect right away. So eventually you learn to deal with, in fact, rely on one another's weaknesses to some degree. To trade with one another as, in fact, friends deal with one another. Not making absolute requirements. There comes a time, in fact, where the statement, "You are not my father," is not a statement of defiance, but comes a statement of loss that you can talk about and share. And I think that takes time, but I think that it's there. One of the things that I have been struck by in dealing with stepchildren is that I cannot replace their father. And my stepsons and I think, are close. But I am not their father. And it's something now that we talk about in those terms, is their loss and our difficulty, to a sense. Finally, I think, and this is something I'm beginning to realize now and have never thought about before, being a stepchild places a tremendous burden on children, particularly as their parents grow up, because they take the kinds of responsibility that children take for parents, have to take for parents, especially as parents get older, and must divide those loyalties, those requirements, between two sets of parents. I mean, parents who are divided, often whose relationships have not resolved themselves and are create conflicting demands for the children, and as they mature, then assume a mature kind of responsibility for both kinds of people. That's not an easy thing to do. And in fact, I think for stepchildren, there comes a kind of role reversal as their parents age. Those are the three or four observations I have about trying to deal with stepchildren. I think mostly we've dealt ad hoc with these things. And we're looking back, trying to see what we've learned, to some degree what we've accomplished, and what we've committed or failed to commit in the process. The other thing that Beck talks about that I think is important is that certainly within our Mormon community, there is almost no discussion whatsoever that we have ever been able to encounter of this difficult undertaking. That for reasons which define and structure our community, it is bracketed out. And that most people who go through this experience go through it very much alone. And so one of the things that Beck certainly wanted to do, and I agree with, and think we need to begin, is some kind of dialogue between people who are going through this experience to see if through whatever it is we learn, we can't help one another in succeeding at it, exceeding as best as we can. And thank you.
Excuse me. We have about 5 or 10 minutes left, and so if anyone has any questions, I'll just repeat them into the microphone. Yes, that would be okay too. Yeah.
Rebecca and Neil, as someone who's facing the possibility of that in my own future, I'm wondering, I think you've set out very, very well the difficulties that as Latter-day Saints we face within our own community. These issues are bracketed out. People are made to feel second-class citizens. Given that it's always touchy territory to kind of make suggestions about, you know, the organization, what the heck at Sunstone? Go right ahead. I mean, what would you suggest, and if you have any suggestions for how we could deal, both on the big level, the macro level, and what we could do just in our own homes, wards, branches, whatever.
How far does it reach? First, I'd say on a personal level, don't underestimate the problems you're going to have. And one of the things Neil and I learned in our marriage is that if we can anticipate a problem, and sometimes when something occurs more than once, you begin to realize it's going to occur every time a certain situation comes up, and talk about it ahead of time, you can diffuse the anger or the emotions. We scheduled a semi-annual argument when we changed children. It took us about 3 years to realize that every time my children left to spend the summer in Utah and his children appeared, that there was this horrendous adjustment period. And after a while, we got so that we expected it, and we'd go running. And we would run around this lake in Cleveland Heights, and, all right, what else do you have to say? Well, all right, here's what I have to say. And by the time we finished the lap, we had pretty well sorted things out. But knowing that this was going to happen and expecting that it would be emotionally charged, and every year it was a little different because the kids were a little different, helped us. I don't think anybody really expects it to be as hard as it's going to be. So if you can at least start with that mindset, that will help you personally. Institutionally, I've really got problems that even at Sunstone are hard to discuss. Any church that has as a precondition for salvation something attached to your marital status, that has these theological underpinnings, is going to have a hard time accepting in full faith and fellowship people who don't fit a norm. And what do we want to do? Advocate the removal of the 121st section of the Doctrine and Covenants? I mean, I don't know how far we can go with the window dressing when the central issue is really theological and the social issues are based on that. So I think it's a big, big problem from any standpoint. Do you want to add to that?
She mentioned the fighting in advance, and that's been good, and we've done that, and we've tried to learn how to fight fair as well. The other thing I think we've had to learn over a long period of time is that there are bottom lines, and that we stop trying to change things and one another. One of the modes of grace we've encountered later on in life is to learn that we approach child rearing with what, at least to us, seem very different attitudes, different sets of parameters. And that occasioned a lot of anger early on. But it seems lately we've learned that both approaches fail in about the same degree, and so that we're able to be more generous about outcomes and styles. And you have to learn to respect one another's bottom line. That is, if you define yourself in a certain way, it's very, very hard without violating yourself to surrender, even when it's a matter of concern about children. And it's very hard, and there's a lot of guilt you carry around about not doing those sorts of things. So those have to be negotiated and thought about. But there has to be a certain level of inviolability, too, a certain bottom line that each of you carries and has to feel good about. The other thing that I think is important that we haven't managed to do is to sort of refuse to be alone. We have known other families who were blended families, but we have not discussed these sort of things with them. And one of the things that you do is you sort of huddle in privacy, because a lot of these things are very painful. And a lot of these things are guilt, occasions for guilt. You know, you feel that you're failing. You must be failing. You must not be doing it right, as with many other things. If we had done things right to begin with, if we had not failed in a former existence, if we had some handle on whatever, gospel principles or on really dealing with children, we'd be doing this right. And so you huddle in privacy. And I think one of the things that's most helpful is to be able to find that you fall in sort of, this has happened to me many times in my life, in some ways it's kind of not useful. That is, I like to think that I'm going through some acute individual experience or pain or trial. And then subsequently I learn that I fall into absolutely all the classical categories. That you can define me in a book or, you know, in somebody's talk, and I think, ah, crap. I'm just like everybody else. But in times of really great pain in the past, it has in fact been very comforting to find that other people share these experiences. And just the fact that you're not alone and that other people have gone through it and can tell you either, well, you can try this, or you can try this, but it will not work. You cannot resolve this. Nobody I know has. Is helpful, so that you should go out of your way to try to open up channels of communication to people who share your experience, and that you know share your experience. And we did not do that, and I think most people don't. I think you huddle in a kind of self-defensive privacy about things. And I think that's a serious mistake. Certainly you're not encouraged to open up, but you have to find ways to do that.
Yeah, okay, just maybe two more questions.
You've spoken about step-parenting, and I was wondering how you've sorted out all the ex-spouse relationships. Okay.
It's still a very sore place, obviously, here. Beck doesn't want to talk about this. It told me ahead of time. And the reason is it's not sorted out. It's not sorted out at all. In some ways better, and in some ways not. It still remains very painful. And that's another thing I think you have to learn. There are things that you don't sort out and that you don't fix. You don't come to terms with. Specifics aside. And you have to adjust your life and fix your life to live with that fact. There's something in my Mormonism, my idealism as a Mormon, that said if you're living the gospel, or you're trying, if your heart and mind are right, you can do it. Whatever it is, you can do it. And I'm here to tell you that there are things that no matter how hard you think you're trying, you cannot fix. You cannot, in essence, fix your children. They are going to be who they are, and they have bottom lines. And you can agonize about it or not agonize about it. And I think what I've had to learn to do is respect it and come to terms with that. And that's certainly true of ex-spouses and your relationships with them.
Did you receive any premarital counseling before your marriage?
Our marriage?
Yes.
Not to do it.
That would help.
Neil and his wife had counseling before they divorced from a non-member of the church, and it actually made their divorce much easier because this person was detached and sort of sorted out the options. My husband and I only saw church counselors, stake presidents, bishops, and well, I know I'm getting to that, and. They refused to counsel us through the divorce, for one thing. They just said, you know, we're here to save marriages, not to help you break one up. So there was no help sorting out that part of it, which I think is why I didn't want to address the issue you raised. I still do not have a good relationship with my ex-husband. I still feel bad about it. His is much better. And I think some help along the way from a professional, detached counselor would have helped. And then to have some counseling for both of us would have been a fine thing. I don't know where to go looking for that. But if it's available, you should certainly take advantage of it. And finding professional help, finding groups to support you are not signs of weakness. They are signs of strength. They are signs of acknowledging that you've got a situation that's going to be difficult to deal with at best. And that's where you should look. Are we out of time, or do we have...
Maybe just one more, and then the rest, if you...
I just wanted to mention one thing that I really thought we'd have time to get to. If you're in this situation or contemplating it, you need to get the Atlantic April 1993 issue, which chronicles all of the research that's been done on the effects of divorce on children. And it has some longitudinal studies that track kids who... do you want to comment on this, Susan?
Actually, I just want to say
well, no, the bias is devastating, and for people who are already in it. But there's all kinds of data about numbers of children who are involved and the effects.
And there's reality that, and it is a slant on the data, too.
Okay.
So it's not...
But when I say don't underestimate the problems, this certainly sets them forth, and I think it's irresponsible not to at least read it.
Yeah.
All right, fair enough. One more question?
One more, and then, yeah.
Well, I guess...
Do you want to forego?
Oh, all right.
The children are worth some sacrifice by parents, as far as, but they're not. I mean, if life is eternal, you can't expect someone to remain in eternal union if they're not compatible. And I guess my question is, how do you think that we, as a church body, can include all of our members, those that are divorced and those that have combined families, and still have a policy or still that, I guess, encourages people to try to sacrifice for their children? I have a friend who's been married for 20 years. He's got a kid on a mission and some in high school, and he's trying to decide whether he's been unhappy with his marriage for 20 years, and he's trying to decide whether to break the marriage off. I mean, how can we reconcile those conflicting...
That's a terrible and a very difficult question. It's very obvious to me that our situation, that is divorce and remarriage, has had consequences for our children. They were not unscathed. They did not walk out free of repercussion from that, and that's very painful. On the other hand, I am not sorry that I divorced, and I'm certainly not sorry about my remarriage. I think it was an eternal kind of decision that I made, needed to make. I'm glad I made. I'm sorry about repercussions. I think life itself is painful. I think the only thing that I can suggest is that these things have to be weighed very carefully, thought through. Options have to be open to you. I mean, the church counseling I went through was of one kind, and I should probably tell you this story because it's helpful. The bishop who first counseled me about my divorce would call me and tell me daily that he was having revelation about this, he was praying about it, and there was no choice. I had no choice. I had to break up this... I had to stay in this relationship. And he knew. And he was a good person. I mean, I liked this person. I did not resent him. He was sincere and faithful, and a bishop trying very hard. But his wife would call me then at other times, regularly, and tell me she admired my courage in getting a divorce. There was nothing she wanted more than a divorce. She was miserable in his marriage. And so I was being counseled by two people. The bishop wanted me to stay in my marriage, and his wife, who desperately wanted me to break it up and wanted out of hers. Which was an interesting sort of existential kind of telephone conversation to carry on. And pushed me very much on my own resources to decide that this was a decision I had to make for myself, that had repercussions, and I had to think about who I was and what that meant, but also for my children. And I carry the hope that my children will survive and that they're doing well and that they are people who have resources on their own, and that some of those resources we gave them along the way. But it's not been without pain or repercussion. There's no way.
Well, it's unfortunately out of time. I just wanted to say that hopefully the Chandlers have opened up some lines of communication that we can take with us and continue individually and as families. And I want to thank you all for coming.